Recording, and I will mute all, but everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. So if you do want to jump in with a comment or question, by all means unmute yourself or put up something into the chat window would be another way. And we'd be happy to entertain any input from all the people attending. So thanks very much for attending, and I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Thanks, Chris. Welcome, everyone. As usual, we have a bunch of different things, so let's jump right in. I'm going to start off with a follow-up from last week. My friend who purchased a $10 Wi-Fi dongle found that it didn't really work all that well, so she took it back to the store and got a couple of different ones, slightly more expensive, kind of, I think one was about $12, the other one was about $22. Well, it was more like $14 and $22, I think. And she found that generally they provided a good internet connection, but she thinks that it doesn't work very well with Gmail. And Chris and I put our heads together, and we couldn't figure out why that would be, but if anybody has any ideas, we'd love to know. Anyway, Chris had a few thoughts about Wi-Fi dongles, so we'll let him talk to that.
Yeah, I think that the if you do buy one, they are going to be different, and so they may have, you know, the better ability for your particular condition to maintain a connection. So what I highly recommend is that you do monitor how well it is working to maintain a connection through the period where you can actually bring it back and get it get your money back. And so if you do have problems, return and try another one. And I don't necessarily say that, you know, you should go to more expensive, not necessarily. I don't think there's fundamentally anything in one design over another that's going to be better or worse. Certainly not in a way that you could determine it. So just try them out until you find one that actually does work. I think there are a lot of factors that could affect how well it maintains a connection in your particular circumstance. Even something like case material could affect signal strength. I think a lot of us remember the Apple problems that they had, where they had a fancy antenna that went around the case, and if you held the phone in a certain way, you'd lose signal. And, you know, so things like that can happen. I think the Gmail issue is just a perception. I don't see that there's any way that the connection could be affected by what service it is that you're actually going to. So I think that's coincidental more than anything else. But if anybody else has any input to that, by all means, jump in.
The only thing I have to add is that I bought a $2 Wi-Fi dongle and a Yagi Aerial that I could screw into it in place of the little rubber ducky one. And I can pick up, I'm near Bronson, and I can, in an apartment building, and I can connect to the Wi-Fi that's at the restaurant on Dow's Lake. So,
holy cow.
I should show you the Yagi. I mean, I wonder where it's gotten to. Anyway, I'll bring that up later. But Yagi Aerial, you know, with all the little repeaters and so on in a row, they're quite effective in narrowing your beam.
How much was your antenna?
The antenna was about, I don't know, $12 or $15.
Wow,
I bought these on eBay from China, so they took a while to arrive.
Yeah. Good price, though.
And Stuart says sometimes just unplugging and plugging it back in again can help if the port's not very stable.
Yeah, one other possible issue is that some various VPN software works better with certain websites than others. For example, I've tried NordVPN and Avast SecureLine VPN, and neither of them works very well with Costco, Home Depot, or in a few other websites, and it might be that if this person is using a VPN as well, it just might not play very well with Gmail.
That's an interesting one.
Okay, Well, if anybody thinks of anything else, they always drop it in the chat window. So moving on, another follow-up from last week. I was talking about Google Keyboard and voice dictation. And my brother-in-law from London, Ontario, Bill, who's on the call tonight, I think I saw him there, now sent me a couple of links which are related. So one of them is this support document from Google, which talks about the different phrases you can use to punctuate the text. So I was talking about new line. It turns out new line is, in fact, the command to go to a new line. The other one that's interesting is new paragraph. That takes it to a new line and then gives you a blank line and starts off a whole new paragraph. So that's a useful one. And the second one was a whole sheet of commands from an organization in Scotland, and all kinds of different things here if you're interested in voice dictation. And the other thing was a document. It's an 8-page PDF file which does a whole bunch of stuff in terms of how to do voice dictation using, in this case, Google Docs, but voice typing in general. And I found a couple of YouTube videos along the same lines. The first one is just different things that you can do with Google Keyboard. And then the second one is actually from a blind individual. I hadn't thought about that, but clearly voice dictation makes a lot of sense if you're blind. And his video was showing how to do capitalization. You'll start a word with a capital letter, and also the problem of how to start a new line. And it's kind of an interesting video. It's very short, but it's really well worthwhile. So all those links will be in the PowerPoint deck that we publish on the website if you're interested in following up on that. The next thing we have is from Stuart, voicemail hell. I think we've all been there, especially these days where you try and find a telephone number for a company you want to talk to, and then you get stuck in these, you know, dial one for this and three for that, and then eventually it comes right back to where you started from, and you never seem to be able to talk to anybody. And this website called gethuman.com is supposed to help solve that problem by giving you telephone numbers that will actually get you to a service agent. And I checked one of these things out. And one of the ones I've been trying to call is TD Canada Trust, and they don't seem to want you to communicate with them by email, which would be my preference, because it's obviously much more efficient to send an email and just get the reply when it comes back. But if you type into the search bar TD, then you get things like TD Bank, which I think is the American, well, it's probably the Toronto Dominion Bank. TD Ameritrade is probably American. The one I was looking at was at the bottom here, TD Canada Trust. And when you do that, it gives you the 800 number, an 866 number, and tells you the current wait time. At this time, it was 6 minutes, which isn't too bad. And it gives you some other phone numbers on the bottom right there for live chat, which I'm not sure live chat works anymore. They don't seem to have that on their website anymore. Anyway, Stuart's found this to be somewhat hit and miss, more miss than hit, I think. But it's probably worth looking if you need a phone number and can't find it easily. Might be a resource to look at in that situation. Okay, a question about a screen display. A friend of a member ended up with this very strange screen configuration. Doesn't know how it happened, and the member doesn't know how to get it back to the normal configuration, but Fortunately, Chris took one look at this and recognized all kinds of problems. So, Chris.
Yeah, okay. So really there's four things that need to be fixed in this. And some people may find this straightforward, but for people that have not delved into the way to configure various options in Windows 10, they may not be aware of things like this happening. So first, they had desktop icons appearing on the taskbar, so we want to remove those. We want to move the taskbar from the top to the bottom of the screen. We want to reduce the size of the taskbar so it's just single bar or perhaps, you know, two lines or something like that, but certainly not half the screen. And then we want to lock the taskbar so that it doesn't happen in the future. So the first problem is removing desktop toolbar. So if you right-click a blank part of the taskbar, and in the screenshot we were provided, the taskbar is in brown. So your taskbar may be a different color, but whatever blank area you can click on or right-click on, and then you will get a pop-up menu, and one of the options on the pop-up menu is toolbars. And if you go to that, you'll see that there is a check mark beside desktop, which means that it is selected. So your desktop icons are actually appearing as part of the taskbar. So if you click on the word desktop, that will deselect it, and then that will remove all of the desktop icons from the taskbar. So that's one step done. Next thing you want to do is probably move the taskbar back to the bottom of the screen where God intended it to be. And so all you have to do is left-click and hold the mouse button down on any blank area of the taskbar. And as you start dragging, it looks like nothing is happening. But just drag down until all of a sudden it'll snap to the bottom of the screen. Now, you can actually snap it to any of the four sides of the screen. So right now in the screenshot, it's snapped to the top. You can snap it to the left, the right, or the bottom. And most people want it to be on the bottom. So when it snaps down to the bottom of the screen, you release the mouse button, and the taskbar will then be down where it belongs. Third thing you need to do is reduce the size of the taskbar, because right now the taskbar is taking up about half the screen. So if you hover the mouse over the top edge of the taskbar, when you get it in the right position, the mouse pointer will change to that double-pointed arrow. And then you just click the left mouse button down and hold it down, and then you drag down until the taskbar is the size that you want it to be. Most likely, just a single line down at the bottom of the screen. But if you wanted to have room for extra icons on there, certainly you could make it like two lines high and something like that. But half the screen is kind of ridiculous. So drag it down until the size you want it, let go of the mouse, and then it'll be down in that position. And then the last thing you want to do is lock the taskbar so that this doesn't accidentally happen in the future. So you right-click any blank part of the taskbar, you'll get a pop-up menu, and you see where it says lock the taskbar, and there's no check mark beside that right now. So it's not locked. So if you left-click on lock the taskbar, it'll put a check mark in there, and it'll lock it so that you can't accidentally resize it, drag it around, things like that. So those four steps should get that taskbar back under order.
For what it's worth, I have my taskbar on the left side because of all the 16:9 screens that I'm using.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, certainly anybody should try them in different positions and see if they prefer it in that. There's no necessarily a reason for you to have it at the bottom. If it works better for you in any of the four positions, go for it.
Well, thanks, Chris. That's really good information. I actually have managed to make my taskbar bigger by mistake. So it's interesting to know how to resize it. Okay. Stuart had a, not really a question. This is more of a share, I guess, but he noticed every now and again in Windows 10 that certain of the options were grayed out, and he didn't really know why, but by searching on Google, he found a way to fix it, which if you're running Windows 10 Pro or whatever, certainly not the Home Edition, you can use the Group Policy Editor to change things. Now, I couldn't look at this because I'm using Windows Home, and it doesn't support the group policy edit feature. So you have to have a more upscale version of Windows to be able to do that.
And just as an aside to that, if you are running Windows 10 Home and you search around, you might come across, oh, and if you don't have Group Policy Editor, because you're using Windows 10 Home, here's how you can use Group Policy Editor in Windows 10 Home. It's not for the faint of heart. I don't recommend that people necessarily go down that route. There are instructions out there that supposedly work, but you're really on your own if you take that route.
Make a disk image first, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, at least, yes.
Well, don't bother with it at all.
And then think twice about whether you really need this.
Okay, here's something for everybody to think about. Somebody wanted to know, is there a way to sign a form that's a Word document on a laptop? And my technique for doing this is as follows. Basically, sign my name on a blank piece of paper, scan that paper and select the signature and store it as a JPEG image. And then in Word, in the signature block, basically paste the image onto the document and then resize it to fit the available space. So here's a Word document with some form or other that requires a signature. There's my image, which I'm just about to paste into the field. And then once I do that, I can basically drag the little buttons on the various corners of the image to resize the signature so it basically fits between the lines and looks beautiful. I don't know if anybody else has any other ways of doing that, but that's the way I do it. I don't see anybody jumping in, so we'll carry on. Anybody has any bright ideas how to do that, put something in the chat window. Okay, Stuart wants to know, what is Windows Core and its modules? And apparently this is the future of Windows. And I found this note on the web, TechGenix. It's a modern version of Windows aimed at making Windows a universal platform for all devices. So they're trying to basically produce a one-stop shop for Windows 10. It'll be modular, so you can develop various versions quickly. And they say that this particular article anyway said the first version is likely to be for mobile devices and subsequently for desktops and for the Xbox. Have anything to add to that, Chris?
Yeah, actually, I had sent you a little bit of information about that, Alan. My understanding of Windows Core is a little bit different. My understanding is that Windows Core is really meant to be a base. And on top of that base, they will then add anything. So that'll be common across all versions of Windows. And then on top of that, they will put modules depending on the device that you're on. So, for example, the start menu might be totally different on a tablet versus a desktop or a mobile phone type format rather than desktop. So the Windows Core would have all of the components about what a taskbar or a start button can really do. And then on top of that would be the user interface, which would be modified for different devices. So, you know, yeah, they have their new two-screen devices out and things like that. So that was my understanding of Windows Core, is that it's the base that'll be common to all. And then on top of that, they put the modules that need to be different depending on the platform that you're actually on.
Okay. The next thing I have is a note on Android smartphones again. And if you saw my presentation at the club meeting a couple of months back, one of the annoyances I mentioned was that sometimes if you don't have a ton of memory on your phone, like an old phone with that doesn't have a huge amount of built-in memory, you can actually run out of free space. And Android's weird. I mean, if you have less than 500 megabytes of free space, on my phone at any rate, if I get a 20 megabyte update, it refuses to install it. It just says there's not enough space and it wants to delete something. And that hasn't been a problem recently. Well, until recently, then I ran into this problem again. And I had like 300 and some megabytes of free space, but again, I couldn't download updates. I couldn't download new apps. I couldn't download new file managers to try and find a file manager that would tell me where all the free space went to. So I had to delete a couple of things. The good news is, my phone in particular, I've rooted the phone. I'm using a custom ROM for Android, so it's a recent version of Android, and it's being kept up to date for security patches. But it also means that I can root the phone, and then I have complete control over the file system. So I installed a couple of different file managers, and one in particular is called, what was it called? Disusage told me more or less what was going on. But then eventually I had to load a different file manager called Explore File Manager, which basically tells me what all the different files are on the system, including the Android root, which normally as a regular user you can't get to. And it also has this really neat feature, like some of the Windows file explorers. It has this thing called Disk Map. So Disk Map basically gives you a pictorial representation of the disk and how much space various programs are taking up. And it was immediately obvious what the problem was. You can see in the little green boxes there at the bottom, this folder called com.fsck.k9, and K9 is my email client. It was using 924 megabytes, so almost a gigabyte of space is being used by my email client. Now, I cleaned out all of the junk mail and that kind of stuff, but it was still using, 900 plus megabytes of space. But when I look at this disk map, I can see what's really happening. It's this folder called at WebView, and in particular a subfolder called Browser Metrics. Browser Metrics is taking 920 megabytes of space for Browser Metrics, whatever they are. And when I look in that particular folder, I find there's more than 200 files in this folder. Each file is more than 4 megabytes, and it's basically just chewing up all of the free space on my phone. So I don't need Browser Metrics, whatever they are. So I dumped the whole thing, got all my free space back. But then I started thinking, well, I wonder what Browser Metrics is. So I ran a Google search. I found in GitHub, somebody had put in a bug report that K9 was taking 800 megabytes of his internal storage. And he found exactly the same problem. It was this Browser Metrics. It was just growing and growing and never being cleaned out by anything. So I put a note on the GitHub website. This is to the developers of K9. Right? It's an open source program, so the source is available on GitHub, and this is a bug report essentially saying that there's a problem. So I added the lower one there, which says I had exactly the same problem. And then a couple of days later, I went back and looked, and the question was, well, it sounds like a platform issue. What version of Android ROM are you using? So I said, well, I'm using this Android 9, which is Lollipop, I think. and from this user called MSE1969, a guy from Germany, on the XDA developer's website. And I gave him the link to that. And it's basically a version of Lineage OS, which is a well-known custom ROM. And then the guy that originally put the bug report on replied, and he says, the people maintaining Lineage OS, including the guy that's developing my particular ROM, resolved the problem by switching System WebView to Bromite. And then he's telling the guy at K9, but let me do something on the code to try and figure this out, because most K9 users are not tech savvy enough to migrate System WebView. So I'm waiting to see some fix here, either in K9 or in a new version of my Android ROM, which will solve the problem. Otherwise, I guess I've got the, not being tech savvy enough like everybody else, I have to go and find out how to deal with this Bromite application to change things. Anyway, I just mentioned that because it's an indication of the power of open source. And, you know, there's a problem, and already somebody's found it, and they're putting in bug reports to the program developers to basically fix things. And things seem to be happening. So I'm really happy with open source products in general.
We had a comment from Tom who said that, well, if the problem was with browser metrics, maybe you need to switch to Imperial measurements.
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, by the way, regarding Android and its browser, I don't know, I presume that WebView is a browser. I'm using Firefox Nightly as my browser, and I've disabled Chrome on my, I have a Pixel 3 XL.
Yeah, I think WebView is actually a process which the browser uses, and it depends which browser it is.
Well, I'm
wondering. I think you're suggesting using this Bromite, which is a different way of whatever process it is, a different way of doing it.
I was actually wondering if the way it was, it's under K9, and so I wonder if it isn't something about the mail client itself rendering certain web content or something like that. So it might be totally unrelated to, you know, your actual browser that is installed.
Yeah, but it's this WebView process needs to be changed.
Yeah.
And changing it to Bromite. I haven't looked up the details, Chris, but you're probably right. It's something like that. It's somewhere in the weeds, that's for sure. Anyway, just an interesting note on open source software there. Now, a question from Bernie. Been trying to delete mail folders in Outlook 2013. Right-click the folder, select delete, confirm the action. Folder goes away. 5 seconds later, it's back again. Now, Chris, I think you have some thoughts on that.
Well, I have some, and Bernie's on the line tonight. So one thing I'd like to confirm with you, Bernie, is that it isn't one of the sort of standard folders, inbox, sent items, or anything like that. It's some other folder that you at some point created. Is that true?
It's subfolders under the inbox that I created.
Okay. Okay, so if you created it, you should be able to delete it for sure. So if it reappears, then I'm guessing that it's something else that is recreating it. Now, are you using IMAP 4 as your means of accessing your mailbox or POP?
I think it's IMAP.
Yeah, okay. That's what I suspected as well, because IMAP is trying to synchronize things between multiple clients. Okay, so do you have any other things like a phone that is accessing the same mailbox through IMAP or another desktop computer?
I have another desktop computer.
Okay. And do you think that maybe that other desktop computer was on at the time that this you tried to delete it on this computer and it reappeared?
That I have to check. I don't.
Okay. What I think it is that some other computer is ending up saying that, oh, okay, this disappeared on the server, but I think it's supposed to be there, and it's recreating that folder. So I think what you're going to have to do is go to each of your devices that is logging in, and you might also log on at the web. So go on to the, like, is it a Gmail account, or is it?
No, it's that's the Rogers account.
Rogers account?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So Rogers has a web-based access to their mail as well. So you could try just going onto there and delete the folder on there. You could also try, if that doesn't fix the problem, then I would try going on at the other computer that you have that is also accessing that and try deleting it at that place and see if, you know, it's one of these other devices that is recreating the folder.
What was funny though, it had some mail in it before, so I eliminated those.
Yeah.
I deleted the mail that was in the folders. Then I said, okay, I got an empty folder. It's useless to me. It's just confusing. So I thought I'd delete it. That's where the problem started.
Yeah. Now, I presume the actual mail that used to be in there didn't come back, just the folder itself?
I'm sorry?
You didn't, the mail that you deleted didn't come back. Eh? It was just the folder itself?
No.
Yeah, okay. So, again, I think you're going to have to go on to each of the devices that are accessing that particular mailbox and try deleting it from each device, not just from the one computer. Worst case scenario to really get rid of it, what you would have to do, I think, is go to that other computer, delete the account on that's accessing your Rogers mail, then go back to your main desktop computer, delete the folder, and make sure that it's staying deleted. Then if you recreate the account on the other computer, that should be okay. But I think if you delete the folder, you know, go to each of the computers that is accessing your Rogers mail through IMAP and, you know, as much synchronized in time as you can, delete it on all of them, then I think that probably will stay deleted.
All right.
Yeah, try that. But also, you might try, just as a first step, just go on to their web interface for the mail. Try deleting it from the web interface and see if that works.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. This is an interesting question and answer from Ollie. Ollie had found that the display on her Sony Vaio laptop would change from horizontal landscape to portrait format all by itself. Obviously, is touching a keyboard shortcut, and it's a problem having to navigate back into settings and change it. So the question was, what's the keyboard shortcut, and can it be reversed, I guess? And by the time I found out that it was actually a Sony Vaio, Ollie had also found out the solution. So the keyboard shortcut is actually Control Alt and one of the arrow keys, and the left arrow rotates the screen 90 degrees counterclockwise, and Control Alt right arrow rotates it clockwise. Interestingly, Control Alt and up arrow restores the previous orientation, I guess whatever that was. And if anybody's interested, Control Alt and down arrow will turn the display upside down. In other words, it rotates it by 180 degrees.
It could be useful in Australia.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, there you go.
It also might be fun if you weren't retired and you go around to different computers that are in your work area adjusting the orientation. It might be fun.
Mm-hmm. It's also quite useful if you if you do rotate the screen, it becomes very difficult to move the mouse because it's 90 degrees from what you're used to.
Yeah. I think I wrote an article for the newsletter about this years ago, and I seem to recall it had to do with the video chipset that you're using. So it was really common to, you know, it was either AMD's video or something like that. But it worked across multiple computers for sure. It was more to do with the video card than anything else. So this may work on other than Sony Vaios as well.
Could part of this be just auto-sensing the orientation of the computer? For example, I have a fairly new Hewlett-Packard Envy, and one of the features that I didn't really want with it, but it came anyway, was you can sort of turn it over and the display would flip over the other way, so you could use it in different ways. And so whenever I shut the computer down or close the computer and take it to another location, I open it up and it's whatever, or the screen is whatever orientation the computer was last in on its own. And it'll reset to a certain extent, but sometimes I have to sort of shake it a couple times.
Yeah, this particular laptop is an older laptop, Bob, so I'm sure it doesn't have an accelerometer to know which way's up. I think this is just brushing one of the hands against the keys and maybe trying to use the arrow key for something else and ending up hitting this particular keyboard shortcut combination. Anyway, that's it for our prepared slides. So does anybody have any other questions, comments, or anything else they would like to share with the group? Don't all yell at once.
Has anybody been having trouble with Excel printing its grid lines since the last Windows update?
Don't know. I haven't tried it.
I have on my main computer. I have downloaded the update. And when I go to Excel now, and I'm used to using Excel, you know, I choose the print area. I go to page layout and the little arrow on the bottom, and I choose grid lines. And it shows the grid lines on the preview. But when it prints the grid lines, it might put two columns in one grid line. And sometimes no grid lines horizontally. When I go to my other computer, my laptop, which hasn't been upgraded to the latest update in Windows, prints it fine. I don't know what to do.
I'm just running Excel on mine, and I'm looking at the view menu here, the page layout menu, and I can turn the grid lines on and off. I usually have them set on, and by default, they're coming on, so.
But I'm talking about when you print.
Well, when you print, okay.
Yeah, just in the printing.
Just off the top of my head, if you can't find a solution, I would definitely throw it into the feedback hub. Yeah, because Microsoft does monitor those things, and if they accidentally screwed up when they did an update, there's a chance that they will very quietly fix it. And in a future update, you'll see it all working again.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. The other thing is, too, if I go to an old file, it prints it fine. It's just whenever I create a new file.
Well, this file I'm showing right here on the print preview is not showing the grid lines.
Yeah, I can't remember ever playing with that to try to get it to display or not.
Don't you actually have to add the grid lines with the box command or the box choice?
I didn't think so either,
but I may be wrong.
Well, what I've looked up so far, it says that, first of all, you have to choose a print area, which I never had to do before. It's a small spreadsheet. So I did that. Then it talks about when you click on that page layout and go to the little arrow here, and you choose grid lines, if it's in draft, you have to change it to normal or whatever, but I can't do that. It doesn't do that in mine. I even went into my own property, so I have my printer set at printing draft until I want to do better. And I even changed that. It didn't make a difference.
This is interesting because
Go to sheet.
I'm just looking at mine right now, and there's a couple of sheets I've got that don't have the grid lines.
Grid lines, yeah. So it shows you. Now when you go to
Did you see that one?
Yeah. Now
I went to page setup and sheet, and there's a grid lines toggle there.
I did that.
I had that toggled off, so it wasn't showing. But if I toggle it back on...
Okay, it shows in the print preview, but when you print it, like I say, you might get two columns in the same, with only the grid lines around two columns. It's really wonky.
Oh, okay.
When you print it, it looks great on the print preview.
I'll have to play with that and see.
I mean, I've gone to the Excel help, and I've did everything they said. Now, I've been using Excel for a long time. I just switched to 365 the other day because I thought that one might have been the problem, that they're not supporting. I had 2020, Microsoft Office Professional 2020, and they're not supporting. And I thought, well, maybe that's the problem. So I did download 365 personal, and it's still doing the same thing.
Yeah, I'm on 2019, and actually on my page layout tab, there is grid lines for view and print. There's two separate checkboxes, and certainly the print preview does show it. Like I can toggle the grid line print on or off, and it's at least in the print preview window, it does show the grid lines either on or off depending on that setting.
Well, mine does too, but the grid lines showing, now try print, and it doesn't print it properly.
Yeah. Well, let me just try printing a page and just see what I get.
No, it depends when you made that file as well.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a file from about a year ago or so.
Yeah. All my old files work. It's just new one.
Let me try a new sheet then and just see what happens on a new sheet.
It may be that the lines are too fine on the new version to actually show up on the printed version. In other words, they show up. Anyway, that's a possible situation.
But you're talking about lines, not grid lines.
With any lines, if they're too fine to be printed on the printer, it may say, "Oh, well, the nearest thing to what I'm looking at is a blank, so I'm going to print white."
Okay, understood. Well, how would you change them to a thicker line?
I presume I know you can change it to a definitely thicker line inside of Excel when you explicitly choose grid lines. You can choose them to be, bigger and blacker. It may be that they're just too fine and somehow they're too fine for the printer to actually show them. It obviously is a bug in the printer or in the printer and Windows Office problems, but I'm not just saying that's a possibility.
And that sounds very interesting, but I still have the problem that it prints the old ones. Okay.
Yeah, I just tried it with a new sheet, and I just printed a couple of cells, and as long as my print layout said grid lines for print, it did print correctly with the grid lines. So, but that's, I mean, every version, it sounds like it's a problem with Office. So I don't think it's the underlying print engine. I think it really sounds like it's an Excel issue. And so I think it's going to be very particular that I'm sure that this isn't the intended way that Microsoft wants it to work. So if your particular build of Excel is exhibiting the problem. So if you do go into Feedback Hub, I would give them the complete build number that you have, which is available under the Help About or under the, where is it? I think if you go to File and then Options, I think it's under there somewhere. No, that's not it. They hide this stuff. Crazy. File and Account will actually show the About Excel. Okay. And I would give the full build number. Like my build is 13426.20332. And so I would, if you do put it something into the Feedback Hub, put in the full build number so they can reproduce it.
Okay. Thank you.
And you might also search in Feedback Hub, because if anybody else has come across this, you know, you're better off to do an upvote on an existing posting in Feedback Hub rather than creating a brand new one.
Okay. Thank you. Sounds good.
Any more questions, comments, or shares?
I don't see anything in the chat.
All right, I got another, a brief PowerPoint on disk partitions if we want.
Sure, we got lots of time, so.
Let me see how we can find that. Okay, there we go. Right, so this is basically a kind of a follow-up on my recent newsletter article on disk partitioning. And I don't know if everybody knows, but a hard drive, you can have a hard drive which just has a single partition. And here's an example. This is actually a second hard drive on one of my desktop machines. It's a terabyte drive, and the thing is formatted as a single NTFS partition. More likely, you have a drive that's got multiple partitions, and this will be at one of my desktops or a laptop that is dual booting Windows. So, for example, here, drive C is the Windows system drive. But there's a second partition over there which contains all my data files. So I call that a data disk. In Windows, it shows up as drive E, because drive D is the optical DVD drive. So I put all of my data files on this drive and access them from the Windows partition. But I dual boot. So I also use exactly the same data files on drive E, or data disk, as Linux would see it. And when I'm running Linux off this partition over here, so I got two operating system partitions, and one Windows, one Linux, and I've got this dedicated partition for personal data files. And clear, there's a couple of other partitions in there as well. There's a system partition, so a small 100 megabyte partition that Microsoft's created. And then there's a couple of gigabytes on the far end, which is a swap partition, swap space, which is used by Linux. So the question, I guess, is if you have a drive, how do you create a disk partition? And the simplest way is to just use Windows and to use their disk management utility. To do that, it has to be run as an administrator, so you need admin permission because you're going to change the makeup of the actual disk. And the process is that you shrink the C drive, so you create some free space. Microsoft calls that unallocated space. And then you use that unallocated space to create a quote, new simple volume, or in other words, a new disk partition. And then if you wish, you can assign a drive letter in Windows to that partition. So here we're running disk management. And you can see on this particular computer, there's actually four drives. There's a C drive, and there's Barracuda, which is a second hard drive. That's that 1 terabyte second hard drive. There's a silicon 16 gigabyte USB drive plugged into it. And then there's also this system reserve partition, which shows up as, I believe it's drive F is the system partition. So we're interested in drive C here. And what we want to do is right click on drive C, and that will pop up this context menu and will allow us to choose shrink volume. So we're going to reduce the amount of space that this drive is taking, 232 gigabytes right now. We're going to create some free space so we can create a second partition or a new partition. And when you choose shrink, then you get all kinds of different ways that you can modify the space. You can choose the amount of space before, the amount of space in the amount of available space, or the amount of space to shrink. And I've chosen to change this to be 60 gigabytes. So I'm going to create 60 gigabytes or thereabouts of free space. And when you change this number, you start changing the other numbers as well, or at least this one you do. Because clearly, as you create more free space, you reduce the amount of available space. Once you do that, you can choose to shrink. And now what we've done is we've created a second piece of disk space, which is unallocated, almost 60 gigabytes. Remember, gigabytes on not 1,000 bytes, it's 1024 or something, so you get a bit less than 60 gigabytes. Now we can right-click on this unallocated space, and we can tell Windows that we want to create a new simple volume, which is a new a formatted disk partition, if you like. So we'll do that, and a couple of things pop up. We can assign a drive letter. So in this case, it gives you all the available drive letters. And you notice you can't choose C and you can't choose D and you can't choose F because that's the system partition. I've decided to just choose drive X. And then the second thing you can do is you can choose to format the partition. And I left it to do a quick format because it's already NTFS essentially. But the interesting thing is to change the volume label to anything you want. And I've chosen to call it data disk because that's what Linux is going to call it. Whereas in Windows, it will decide that it's drive E, I guess. No, it can be drive X. I told it drive X. Right. So Windows uses a drive letter. Linux uses the volume label as the name of the partition. And then once we've done that, then we end up with a new drive, drive X, which is about 60 gigabytes. And now I can use that as my dedicated data drive. Now the question is, what happens if you want to do more complicated things than that? Because disk management is a bit limited in terms of what it will and won't do. The program I use generally is Gparted. And it's a Linux application, essentially, which you can set up as a standalone bootable disk. I use an external USB. Boot into Linux, and automatically it runs G-parted, and it comes up with this horrendous looking thing. But basically, it's giving you all the different partitions in a pictorial format along the top here. And then the individual partitions are listed down here with the file type and the mount names and that kind of thing and the sizes. So you have a really good idea of what's going on. And then you also have all these menu options that you can choose the device, you can edit the device, you can do all kinds of weird and wonderful things with this thing. There is a learning curve to how to use this, but it's very powerful. And there's a really good tutorial on how to drive this system. And it will do any kind of disk formatting, disk modification operation that you want. So there you go. That's my quick and dirty on
partitioning. Yeah, a couple of things on those, Alan, before we move on. Tom posted in the chat that he uses network letters starting from Z going backwards. I think this is a really important concept because if you have an external drive that you plug into your system, by default, it'll pick up the next available drive letter. So say you only have one available partition, so it's drive C. You plug in an external hard drive, it picks up drive D, and you start using it. And then one day you disconnect it from the drive or it's powered off or something like that, and you plug in a flash drive or something, and it happens to pick up drive D. And then you plug in your external hard drive, and all of a sudden it becomes drive E. And so this idea that they shuffle around can be a real pain in the butt. So I like to, especially for anything that is going to be used repeatedly, when I plug it in the first time, I go into disk management and I tell Windows that I want this to always use certain drive letter. And then it'll lock that in. It knows that device, and it'll always come up with that particular drive letter so you don't get things bouncing around on you, which is really nice.
It's also really important if you use batch files.
Exactly.
Because you have to have the right drive letter.
Yeah, or if you have tasks that are dependent upon something being in a particular location and so forth.
Actually, the drive letter stays with it as long as nothing else has taken the drive letter. Yeah. That's why I put it towards the end. I mean, my data drive is my Z drive. My CD DVD is W. I have X and Y being some of the recovery drives partitions. I've changed those, and they stay the same because nothing else kind of bounces them out of the way.
Yeah. That's as I said, that's the problem is if you don't do that, then you end up with this problem potentially. If it picks up drive D and then you disconnect it and you plug in something else, it might take drive D, and then you plug in that other device, and then it can't take D because D is in use, and so it all of a sudden bounces to E and things like that. So starting at the high end of the alphabet and working backwards, or just starting way up in the alphabet, regardless if you go all the way to the end, is a good thing. Also, Tom mentioned that you're limited to 4 logical volumes on a single physical disk. Now, I believe that's on a simple volume. Now, there is a partitioning scheme that allows for more than 4 volumes, I believe. But I can't remember what it is.
I think it's GPT.
Okay, GPT. And I'm not sure the downside to using a GPT.
I don't think there is one.
Yeah, so potentially if you know that you want to have more than 4 partitions or logical volumes on that drive, you might want to look to using that instead. But
well, it's not logical volumes necessarily, is it? It's the primary partitions, they call them.
Right.
The MBR only lets you have 4 primary partitions. If you have a logical volume, then you can have all kinds of different partitions inside of that.
Oh, okay.
That's basically what Linux does.
Okay.
Okay, well, I guess we got a couple of minutes to go, so let's just start to wrap up a little bit. We'll have a Q&A next week, so the 30th, next Wednesday. If you have any questions or topics you want to share, send it to our suggestion box. And of course, in the next couple of days, something's happening, then Stu wants to know about it. And he has this this question. So for the mathematically challenged, this will be on the deck that we post to the website, and you can figure out all the algebra there. But in the meantime, have a great Christmas, everyone.
Well, I think we have one other question from Mitch Lynch. She says, there is a Zoom question above.
Oh, yeah. Should my housing co-op use the Zoom app for their AGM or use online Zoom as with this meeting? Well, it depends what people are doing, because I'm using the Zoom app, and I'm sure some people are using the browser version of Zoom. So you can do either, right?
I'm using the Zoom app. I didn't know there was a browser version.
Yeah, they definitely do have a browser version.
I think they recommend that you download and use the app, but if you don't install the app, you can access it directly through the browser.
Do you have the same controls in the browser on video and audio and moving things around and stuff like that? I'm using two screens. I'm using three screens to see the Alan German screen with Santa Claus, and then all the gallery of the people, and then the chat in another half of a screen. So it's I'm doing that in the app. Do you have the same? I don't think you have the same flexibility if you're using the browser.
There is a site on Zoom's website somewhere that talks about the different differences between using the app or the a web browser, and it goes into detail about it. I'm sure that the app gives additional capabilities that the web browser plugin doesn't give you, but Zoom details it somewhere. So
Gail's saying she's used both, found the options slightly different, and the location of the options are in different places, of course. But it sounds like you can do some of the same things anyway if you've got the same options.
I looked at it a long, long time ago, and I quickly decided that I would use the app, and because there are additional capabilities. I can't remember off the top of my head what they are, but as I say, they are detailed on the Zoom website.
Yeah, I think the general intention is that if you're going to use it regularly, use the app.
Yeah.
If it's a once in a blue moon sort of thing, well, then just click on a link and...
Yeah, I found the same thing with Microsoft Teams. Teams, you could use a web browser, and because I didn't use Teams very much, I remember using it one time through the web browser, and then in the middle of the meeting, because they wanted us to do something that I couldn't do, I had to actually leave the meeting and come back in using the app to do it. So since then, if they offer an app, fine, I'll use their app.
There's no ay-ay-ay in team.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, any last questions before we leave? Okay, you got a couple of the standard last slides there for us, Alan?
Oh, we've done them. Yes, that's it.
Okay. Okay, thanks very much, all. So we'll see you for one more meeting in 2020. Have a good Christmas.
Likewise.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Again.